to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of the Information Radio Network, its affiliates, stations, or advertisers.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next view hour, they're going to be the views of Sharon Harris and Al Copeland. We're going to be talking about a recent nutritional discovery that's able to get important nutrients into the lives and into your body and can literally save your life. Let me introduce our speaker for this evening, Sharon. Sharon Harris, a co-creator of the Heart and Body Extract. Hi, Sharon. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. And and then we have Al Copeland, who's a blood microscopist and who does blood analysis, and he's calling from our Lynchburg, Virginia. Al, are you there? Well, let's see. I guess we don't have Al just yet, so let's go ahead and get started talking to Sharon about Heart and Body Extract, which she produces. And so what is Heart and Body Extract, and why is it important for people to take it?
Well, Heart and Body Extract is a nutritional supplement. It's made out of garlic, hawthorn berries, hawthorn leaves, coleus, motherwort, butcher's broom, bilberry, kelp, mistletoe, ginger, and cayenne pepper. It's an important formula to take because it's really very excellent and it's very helpful for a number of different challenges that we may have to face. For example, myself, when I was 45 going on 46, that was like 8 years ago, I thought I had a good diet. I mean, I was eating vegetarian, lots of vegetables and fruits, and wasn't eating very much meat. If I did, I would have a little bit of turkey or you know, fish, like salmon, good quality salmon. And I would eat salads, and I'd be going out for walks, and I'd be going swimming. But even though I had good dietary habits and I had good exercise habits, my body was slowly falling apart, actually, and in a bad way. What was happening to me was I had very high blood pressure. It was 160 over 110. That's considered severe. At the same time, I had a regular heartbeat episodes where my heart would be racing and skipping beats and palpitating. And I could be standing up in the kitchen 1 minute and keel over the next kind of thing. And at the same time as that, I had problems with congestive heart failure, whereby my heart was enlarged, I was very tired, very lethargic, I would need to have a nap at 3 o'clock in the afternoon just to get by, my feet were very swollen, I couldn't use my regular shoes, my ankles were swollen, my legs were swollen, very, very fatigued, that's a big thing, and I could hardly walk up the stairs, very weak. So, gee, and I was only 45, eating well. So anyway, I tried many different things to try to help myself. I tried vitamins, I tried minerals, I tried amino acids, I tried teas, I tried herbal formula, and nothing would work for me. As much as I tried, I couldn't get any results. Finally, when I started getting really bad nosebleeds and really bad headaches, I went to the physician and the doctor said to me, "Well, you better go on a diuretic drug for your high blood pressure. I don't want to see you dead at 45. And so reluctantly, I went on the blood pressure medicine and unfortunately didn't do very well. I was confused and I was peeing like crazy. And my quality of life was really bad. I thought, whoa, this is not a very nice way to live this way. So in frustration, I basically prayed to the Lord, what am I going to do? And I had an answer come to me, and that was to hire a master herbologist who would help me create a formula that would help myself and help others.
Hold that thought.
Yes.
All right, go right ahead, Sharon.
Yes, so what happened was within 2 weeks of using the Hearts and Body Extract, my blood pressure went from 120 over 80 to 120 over 70. I took that blood pressure reading several times because I couldn't believe my good fortune. I said to my husband, is this true, 120 over 70? Am I seeing this right, 120 over 70? 120 over 70? He said, yeah, that's what it is. So I was so happy because I was out of the danger zone. I wasn't in fear of having an imminent heart attack or stroke. And I was much more, you know, at peace. Within about 5 days of using the Heart and Body Extract, the irregular heartbeat problems started to cease, and they were regulated. I wasn't having the palpitations. I wasn't having the racing heart. I wasn't having the skipping beats. My beats were calm, and they were regular. And within 30 days or so, I lost a lot of the water weight of my legs and my feet, and my energy started to get better. I was able to walk further, go up the stairs easier, and my heart was not as enlarged. Within 6 months, it was back to normal. So very, very excited about those results.
Well, I'm sure you would be. And so basically, how do you actually take the Heart and Body Extract?
Right. Well, it's a liquid formula. Liquids are best. With liquids, you have the best assimilation and absorption into the cells. It's very portable. We have two sizes. We have a 1 month supply. We have a 2 month supply. You could basically put that into your suitcase, a suitcase for traveling, certainly. You could put it in your purse or briefcase. You could put it in your car. It's not sensitive to cold. It's not sensitive to hot for people out in Phoenix and California, etc. They need not worry about that. But basically 15 drops, which is an inch from the bottom of the dropper, hold it in your mouth for a minute or two, and then swallow 3 times a day. Morning, afternoon, and evening.
All right, fine. And so we're going to be back here in just a moment, and we'll get Al Copeland on the line. And Al apparently is a blood microbiologist, and he actually lives in Lynchburg, and we're going to be talking to him a little bit about really what's going on. And you actually live up there, in Vancouver, Canada?
Yeah, I live in the Vancouver area, yes. Vancouver area is very pretty. We have the ocean, we have the mountains, and we have a lot of green grass and very beautiful flowers. Unfortunately, about 6 months of the year is quite cold and rainy, but around this time it's starting to be really nice.
It's one of the most beautiful cities in the world. I've always felt that. I love Vancouver. Hang on, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sharon was just telling us, of course, really what a dramatic effect the Heart and Body Extract had had on her as far as her blood pressure, as far as her heart irregularity, and even the size of her heart after she'd been on it for a period of time had improved, and her swelling improved, and so she decided simply to go ahead and market the product. She felt it was good and effective, and so let's go to Al Copeland, and he's a blood microbiologist, and hi, Al, are you there?
Yes, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself? What do you do as far as blood is concerned?
Well, what I do, blood microscopy, involves taking 2 drops of blood at the finger and put it under the microscope within the first 3 to 5 minutes from the time it leaves the body. Now, what that does, that gives an indication, and it's over 100 plus year old science, and it's the way it used to a lot of doctors and health consultants used to find out just what were the imbalances and deficiencies going on with the body. So when you look at the blood in its last state, you can see so many things that is going on with the body. In other words, things that may cause a serious health condition 2 years or even 5 years down the road is already, the breakdown process is already taking place. Because in Leviticus, the 17th chapter, 11 through the 14th verse, it says the life of the soul of man and beast is in the blood. When you look at the blood in its live state, that's, you can really see that. Because if a person is deficient in, verse, B vitamins, if they have a hormone imbalance that's starting to take place, if they have over acidity taking place, if they have like dehydration, if they have excess amounts of meat and where the proteins and so forth don't break down like it needs to, all that shows up in the blood as excess debris, waste, and you see bacteria, you see fungi, you just see a lot of things that is that science and has proven and research has shown that it is the major contributing factor to breakdown of the body and premature aging of the body.
Well, now, do you actually, when you take the blood, actually, do you just use the blood or do you put some sort of a something in it to keep it from clotting?
Oh, no. You don't. In fact, healthy blood, if it's flowing freely, you will see in one drop of blood, we have tens of thousands of cells. When you put that drop of blood under the microscope, normally within up to 45 minutes to an hour, it will continue to have, the cells will continue to move and flow in a sort of it's like a dancing-like manner where the cells will touch each other and bounce off, touch each other and bounce off, and so forth for up to 35, 40 minutes. Now, if the blood is unhealthy, if it's not getting the proper nutrients and oxygenation, and there's bacteria and other things has started to take over the blood within the first 1, 3 to 5 minutes of the blood, it just starts, all the cells will start to stick together. If low oxygenation, if there's if it's nutritional and so forth is very low, and the negative charge, too much acid in the body, it causes the cells to stick together, and the flow is not there. So there's nothing added to the blood at all.
Okay, well now, how do you then maintain your healthy blood?
Well, in order to maintain your blood, your healthy blood is so critically important. One of the things is that, of course, we maintain a level of hydration and the nutritionals that we put in our body. The body is alive, and every cell has electromagnetic charge or electrical charge to it. And the only way you can get that charge and keep it healthy and maintain is to, you have to eat food that has life in it. The most of the food, 70-80% of the food we eat should contain life, should be from natural things like raw organic vegetables, fruits, and other types of food that's more raw foods and live foods, and maybe just 20-25% of other type foods that may be more acid or food that's more alkaline. And that's what the heart and body, where it comes in, it comes from natural extracts of plants, and being that in order for anything for the body to utilize it, it must break down into a liquid form. And with all the herbs and things that's in the heart and body, it has various other vitamins and things that breaks, it has minerals in it. It also has many other nutritionals that has properties that help the blood and the cells and so forth to be free, where it can flow more freely.
All right,
then you take it and put it under the tongue, and it goes subliminally and directly into the bloodstream, so there's no breakdown for us in the stomach, in the liver, and don't have to go through the regular digestion process. That's the reason why it gets such a high absorption, up to 90%+ absorption.
Well, can you describe some of your experiences or your clients' experiences with heart and body extract?
Well, I've had a number of clients. One of the things that I found that people have numbness in the lower extremities. They within a matter of the first bottle or so, that began to improve tremendously. A lot of people have problem with high blood pressure today, and that has a lot to do with the blood being thick, it's not flowing, when the cells all stick together, called platelet aggregation. And after first bottle, so taking the heart and the body, the blood pressure number of clients who that has happened, who have gone to the doctor, they put tried them on every medication that was known and could never get the blood pressure under control. After the first 2 to 3 weeks of first body, heart and body, the blood pressure normalized. People have had different types of, like enlarged hearts, have noticed that there's been a, after a month or so, going back to the doctor, and noticed that they, their heart is shrunk. People have swollen extremities, same thing. Angina pain has been amazing within, I've had people within 2 to 3 or 4 days, angina pain dramatically subsided. When people took the heart and body. I've been in nutrition myself over 30-some years, and I've been doing a blood micropathy for over 7 years, and all my years I've been into health, I've never seen any one product that affects and benefits in people in so many ways. One of the reasons, because the heart pumps the blood to every organ, every tissue, kidneys, liver, and so forth. So it's very important that the body maintains proper blood flow, because in order for nutritionals that we eat, nutritionals that we take, nutrition from the food, and for oxygen to be processed properly, the blood has to be flowing in a free manner.
I wonder how long should a person stay on heart and body extract?
Well, being a heart and body extract is a whole, it's a basic whole food, and that's what the body has to have. So it's I would say a lifetime, because of it, what the American Heart Association, American Medical Association has found out, that at the age of between 25 to 35, most of the population have some kind of blockage. And so if that's the case, and as we age, the body ability to, as far as to the blood flow and of the body and so forth in the veins and vessels begin to break down, and they have found over 90 different enzymes in the arteries itself. So with the heart and body health, it being a whole food, literally it's like food for the heart, food for the arteries. So it's like you eating that liquid food that goes into all the 70 to 100,000 miles of vessels and veins and microcapillaries throughout the body. That needs to be fed. So I would say a lifetime, and that's what I'm planning on being on it, because in fact, it's so much easier to prevent a heart attack or stroke and so forth if you can help the body, assist the body by giving it what it needs, the proper nutrition, and the heart body has some of the most powerful nutritionals and herbs in it that's been used even back in biblical days to help maintain heart health.
All right, fine. Well, Sharon, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your organization and get more information about the Heart and Body Extract, or HB Extract. What's the telephone number to call?
Sure. The phone number to call is 1-866-295-5305. I'll say that again, 1-866-295-5305. Our website is www.HBExtract.com. Again, HBExtract.com.
Okay, that's just HBExtract.com. Now, basically, what about taking this with prescription drugs or other medications? Is there any interaction there?
The product is very safe. It's a herbal formula, and the herbs that we chose are very gentle, yet they're very effective, and they're very synergetic in terms of giving the body what it needs to heal itself. For best results, though, we ask that people take the formula an hour apart from any prescription drugs. And the reason for that is so that the product works as best as it can for the best results. No negative side effects, no negative contraindications with any condition, any health concern, or any drug. So very safe. Just an hour apart for the best results.
All right, now if you're out in the listening audience, you have a question for Sharon or for Al, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Sharon, what is the success rate with HB Extract?
Our success rate success rate is actually really high. Provided a person uses it as directed, 15 drops three times a day, the more, you know, compliant a person is on the suggested doses, the better the results. However, I've seen people get good results with less, but we don't recommend that because we want you to have the very, very best that the product has to offer. So using it as recommended is very important.
Hold that thought for just a moment.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest today is Sharon Hughes. Sharon Harris, we're talking about HB extract. It looks like we have a couple of people who are calling in.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances? Even things which can cause sickness or disease. If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Number, if you'd like to call Sharon, you have any sort of a question, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, I've been taking this, I guess about a month and a half now, and I certainly think it's actually seems to energize me a bit. What about energy? What about people are fatigued all the time? Does this help them?
Yeah, the product is actually really, really excellent for energy. It is super for that kind of challenge. It also is very helpful for many people to help them to sleep better for some reason. It's also helpful to give people relaxation. If I happen to be stressed over something, I take a shot of the Heart and Body, and it's very relaxing. Within about 5 minutes, you start to feel calmer. So it has a calming effect. Yet at the same time, which is kind of like the opposite, it has an energizing effect too. You're calm, yet you're energetic. So that's a good feeling.
Well, of course, herbs have been used for, you know, in China for 5,000, 6,000 years, and so they've been very, very effective there. They're discouraged here in the United States because they compete with the pharmaceuticals, and the pharmaceutical industry really runs things pretty well as far as the FDA is concerned, tells them what to do. The largest single source of funding for the Federal Drug Administration in the United States is the pharmaceutical industry. And, of course, supposedly they're subsidizing the FDA so that they can, you know, check out to find out if the products are effective. But the problem with that is he who pays the piper calls the tune. And, of course, there's an organized effort to discourage the use of many things, many products that are known to be effective that are used throughout the world. And of course, we just do not have access to them here in America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, Sharon, you know, as far as this is this used, you know, certainly in other countries besides the United States and Canada?
Oh, yeah. I mean, with the power of the Internet, we have clients all over the world. I mean, we have clients in Singapore, Malaysia, UK, Australia, New Zealand, all over the place. Africa, I've got a doctor out there, a natural doctor that's helping people out in Africa. So it's really very joyous to be able to help people to regain their health back, to regain a quality of health back. And we do have clients all over the world, and that's due to the power of the Internet. I mean, I'm sure, Dr. Stan, some people can hear your show somewhere off in England.
We have listeners all around the world. We know that.
Exactly.
And certainly the miracle of shortwave, even the shortwave broadcasts are heard in many other countries as well.
Exactly. So that's how people start to hear about us. They hear our interviews, and they say, and then go on to the website, and then we can ship anywhere in the world practically. I mean, there's a few countries that we need to be careful with, but not too many. Most of them we can simply send out by air dispatch out of Canada for international, and it's reasonable, only $10 to ship international, and they get it within a week or 10 days or so, and nice and safe.
Well, Al, certainly, can you tell the difference in the blood between somebody who's on the product and not on the product?
Yes, one thing about, like I said earlier, in order for the blood to flow properly, it must have nourishment from whole food. And when the blood is acidic and people are not getting proper nourishment, proper oxygenation, the blood has a thickness, or all the cells stick together, and the blood flows more freely. I want to interject that one of the things that is very, very important for anybody who's diabetic, because one thing about being diabetic, and it breaks the veins down. Diabetes really breaks the veins down. So the Heart and Body has been proven extremely, extremely effective for people who are diabetics, because of the fact it helps to nourish and restore, because like the bush's broom, the hawthorn, and the other nutrients, herbs in the Heart and Body helps to strengthen the arteries and help give the flexibility and help slow down and prevent the hardening of the arteries. Therefore, the stronger the arteries, being the arteries are muscle, is able to contract and expand like it's supposed to, and which gives more blood flow, especially to the lower extremities.
Okay, well,
all across the body.
Sharon, will you go ahead and get your telephone number off one more time here?
Sure, okay. So the phone number is 866-295-5305. Again, 866-295-5305. 5305. The website is H as in Harry, B as in Bobby, extract.com, hbextract.com.
Well, God bless. And thank you very much for Al being with us tonight, and thank you very much, Sarah.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. Good. Bye.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed that rendition of God Bless America. You know, we don't hear that much anymore. In fact, when I first started doing my programs, we used that as a theme song, and, well, we've decided to go back to it. I mean, it's an organized effort to keep that song from being widely played in America. Americans love it. Most Americans are very, very patriotic. But you must understand that there really are people who work within the music industry who have suppressed songs that are patriotic, that tend to encourage people to love our country, to be concerned about what's going on. An example would be Steve Foss's wonderful film, Let's Take America Back, and we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course I should mention that Sharon Harris and the HB Extract does support Radio Liberty, and we appreciate their support, but we're going to do open lines this next half hour. So if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment on any subject, why, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we're hearing a lot about a new form of a virus, an influenza virus that's now, of course, apparently has killed a certain number of people down in Mexico. We're hearing that the virus is here in the United States. Don't think it's killed anybody yet, but there have been some cases in a couple of areas of the country. And apparently it's a combination of an avian virus and a human virus and a bird virus. And where did these viruses come from? Well, we know that actually they create viruses in the laboratory. In fact, of all the absurd things, people went up into the permafrost to dig up bodies from people who had died during the great influenza back in 1918 to get this virus to begin to actually
to grow it within the, you know, in the laboratories. And this was an extremely deadly virus. This virus was actually, it had actually killed, somewhere between 20 million and 100 million people at the time of the Second World War in 1918, as the war was ending in the year immediately after that. And I mean, it was a terrible, deadly virus, and yet, certainly there had been no significant cases, really no cases of that, because, of course, all the people who had it died, the other people had immunity to it, and the virus didn't exist. So I would like to ask you, from a rational point of view, why would anybody go up into the permafrost and dig up? And they did this in several areas. One, I believe, up in the North American continent. Another one over in Scandinavia, and dig up bodies with the virus and then begin to grow it in the laboratory, unless they were planning on using that, of course, against people. Now, it's very difficult to honestly believe that anybody would want to create new diseases that would kill people. And that's because, of course, you've never read Dr. David MacArthur's testimony before the Military Appropriations Committee back in 1969. We have the complete text of that testimony, and it is available through Radio Liberty. We have one page if you want it, or the entire testimony. But Dr. David MacArthur, testifying before the House Appropriations Committee, actually asked the Congress to appropriate $10 million so they could produce a new deadly disease. And this would be one that would destroy the immune system, so there'd be no response to disease. And of course, he said, some people say we shouldn't do this because it'd be another form of mass killing. But we want to do this. We think it's important that we do this. It's important that we can find out if this sort of a organism can be created. And Congress appropriated $10 million. Now, some people say that at the same time that money was appropriated to create a chronic disease. Now, we do know that it was the following year, in 1970, with Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book, Between Two Ages, and a very interesting study in thought control, is to go up on Amazon and try to buy a copy of this little paperback book, which, of course, sold very cheaply, $6 or $7 when it was published. But now, I mean, the cheapest copies are $60 or $70, and even more than that, because they don't want you to read what Zbigniew Brzezinski said the year after David MacArthur testified before Congress and asked for $10 million to create these new diseases. And certainly Zbigniew Brzezinski, I believe it's the page, the bottom of the footnote at the bottom of the page, somewhere between page 56 and 66. I think it was 56, but we'll be glad. Anybody who wants to get copies of the page, we'll be glad to provide it. Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski said, quoting someone, an expert, that in the future we're going to be able to create storms, and 30 years from now we'll be able to create storms and droughts and, of course, new chronic diseases that will disable large parts of the population. Well, of course, that would have been about the year 2000, but long before that we had these new diseases. We had Lyme disease, which actually has disabled well over 1 million people, probably closer to 2 million. And yet everything has been done by the medical establishment to claim the disease doesn't exist, or if it does exist, why, of course, it's simply psychological, there's nothing to this. And the doctors who try to treat these unfortunate people with Lyme disease are really sort of on fringe, and many times they risk their licenses by actually treating people with a terrible disabling disease. And then we had the chronic fatigue syndrome come up just about the same time in 1980. And then we had AIDS come up just about the same time. And then we had, of course, the chronic fatigue syndrome, which is very similar to the other two. And then, of course, in 1990, while we had the Gulf War illness, and they all are interlocked with the same disease using a chronic genetically engineered mycoplasm. How do I know it's genetically engineered? Why? Because the Defense Department actually has a patent on that genetically modified. I think it's the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology actually has a patent on this new life form, this new genetically form of mycoplasm. And you see the mycoplasm in all of the diseases I mentioned. Most doctors have no idea that almost well, literally every case of AIDS, is not only HIV, because that's what we talk about, but the mycoplasm, this genetically aired mycoplasm, which, of course, can do a great deal of damage and harm to almost every organ system, is combined with the HIV. And how did these diseases come about? Well, they put out a great deal of disinformation. The last thing they want is for anybody to suspect that anybody be so evil and crass that they would actually create new diseases. But this is what they did. And the CIA funded this. And, of course, what they did is they hired scientists from all over the country. Most of them really didn't have any idea what they were working on. They were just asked to investigate one specific part of the whole issue. It was only a very, very small number of intelligence officials and doctors who understood how it all fit together. And the CIA actually printed every year something called the Special Virus Cancer Project. It was a great big book, about 2 inches thick, with just summaries of all of the scientific studies and all of the scientists who were involved in this process. Well, of course, when some of the investigating committees began to looking into the CIA and what they'd been doing, why, of course, they began to shred, and they tried to shred all of the copies of all of these reports. But fortunately, the CIA isn't as efficient as they'd like to have us believe, and they forgot some of the copies, and they, of course, were obtained by Len Horowitz and our friend Don Scott and by Lloyd Graves. And so we do have copies of literally all of these various government reports going into the background of how they created the new diseases. And they actually tell you that they're creating new diseases. And of course, you can purchase copies from Lloyd Graves or Don Scott of these books on the Special Virus Cancer Project. And you have to understand that they actually created new diseases. Now, do we have any other evidence? Yes. There's a book called Full Disclosure, I think it's written by Gary Glum, and it was written based upon information given to him, to Gary Glum, by a man who was dying of pancreatic cancer. He had first been threatened and told he'd be killed if he ever revealed anything. He'd signed all sorts of government secrecy documents, but he was dying anyway. And so Gary Glum wrote the book, Full Disclosure, based upon what he was told by this man who'd been part of the program to create the AIDS virus, which has killed probably close to 40 or 50 million human beings. And, of course, there are probably almost that many infected now who will eventually die from it. And this is a very race-specific disease. It's primarily designed to kill off blacks because there's an intense hatred of blacks within the dark side that is behind all of this. And that, of course, is why they found that genetic differences between black and white, and they tended to exploit them. If you go to my website and pull down my articles on population control, we'll actually give you the references where the South Africans were working to create race-specific diseases that would kill off the blacks of South Africa. The Israelis were working on race-specific diseases that would kill off the Arab, but not the black. Pardon me, but not the Israeli. And people say, how could anybody be that crass? Well, certainly there were elements within our government where we're doing exactly the same thing, but they cannot let the American people know what's going on. And yet in the United States today, and anybody wants to see the article, I just pulled it down from the CDC, pointing out that 1 in 16 black men in the United States will contract HIV disease during their lifetime. 1 in 16 black adults and 1 in 30 black women. 1 in 16 black men will contract HIV disease and 1 in 30 black women will contract HIV disease. And of course, they're going to, in all probability, die of these diseases. Here in America, of course, where blacks make up 13% of the population, why, of course, they actually make up almost 50% of all the new HIV or AIDS cases. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you because I have nothing prepared. And, of course, when we do open lines, we depend upon you calling in to help us, you know, get through the rest of the program. Under any circumstances, it is a terrible thing to contemplate. This sort of thing goes on in the real world, but it really does. Those of you who haven't read the book, it's admittedly it's fiction. It's written by Tom Clancy. It's called The Rainbow Six. But in the foreword of that book, Tom Clancy said, you know, this is a book of fiction, but a great deal of accurate information in this book that the government does not want you to know. And, of course, it's the story of a group of the so-called environmentalists who decided they were going to kill off a large part of the population. They developed a new disease that they were going to use and create a limited epidemic, and of course with the potential to spread across the country. But the real clincher in the whole thing was they were going to vaccinate everybody, and the vaccines, which are going to be given spontaneously across the world, did contain a deadly virus that's going to kill off 95% of the population of the world. Is it only coincidence that recently Baxter created a influenza vaccine that contained the H5N1 virus? Fortunately, of course, it wasn't disseminated, it wasn't distributed. The Czechoslovakians got a sample of this new vaccine. They injected it into hamsters, and the hamsters all died. And so then they checked it out, and here enough, what they're doing is giving people the avian bird flu. Why would anybody do anything that ridiculous? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have people who look at the world differently. If you want other books, we carry a book called AIDS, the Crime Beyond Description by Don Scott. It's a very large 500-page book. We think it's an important book. We carry the book by Dr. Garth Nicholson, one of the world's leading scientists. It's called Project Daylily, and there's only one L in Lily. Project Daylily, of course, is a fictionalized account of Dr. Garth Nicholson's life and his wife's life when, of course, he was a tenured professor at the H.B. Anderson Clinic there in Houston, Texas. The attempts on their life, because they investigated some of these macabre experiments, all of the people that he knew who were killed because they were looking into some of the experiments done at Huntsville, Texas. And, of course, in other areas where they were experimenting with these deadly mycoplasms that, of course, are in, you can find people with Gulf War illness. You can find them in people with Lyme disease. You can find them in people with chronic fibromyalgia. You can find them in people with chronic fatigue. You can find them in people with AIDS. Anyway, we carry the book, Project Daylily. We think it's an important part of our armamentarium. So the three books, one we don't carry, full disclosure. One called Project Daylily by Dr. Garth Nicholson, a fictionalized story, but it's really all very true. They've only changed the names there. And, of course, then the third book would be AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief by Don Scott. Going to the background, of course, is this terrible, terrible AIDS epidemic that's probably killed but close to 50 million people at the present time. And today in Botswana, thanks to American tax dollars, 46% of the pregnant women are HIV-infected, and they're all going to die. Are you concerned, ladies and gentlemen? Because, of course, if you're not concerned about the suffering that American policy is bringing throughout the world, why will you have any right to be concerned when it's you, your family, or a loved one? Well, let's go to Ruby is calling from Live Oak. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And hi, Ruby. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
I was listening to your show earlier with, I forgot her name. The one with
her name was Sharon Harris.
And I've noticed several weeks ago, I was listening to your show, and I'm thinking, man, he's so sharp. He catches every little thing, and I'm thinking, he sounds better than he has, even. And I'm thinking that maybe that heart and body extract that you've been taking is really, really affecting you, and it sounds like a pretty good product to me. I am very interested in the things that you're saying. One comment that I have is that I do have a friend who has Lyme disease. Unfortunately, she can't take the heart and body extract. We've already researched the whole thing because she has some allergic reactions to some of the things in there. But it sounds like a very, very good product. I wanted to ask your opinion about something we were looking on the computer, and we actually printed off this picture of Obama bowing to this Saudi Arabian king, Abdullah, during the G20 summit. And I just wanted to know if you had a comment on that, and also we all saw on the computer today where they covered up all the Christian symbols at Georgetown University. I thought we had freedom of religion in this country, or is that gone already, or what?
Ruby, you must understand there's an intense hatred of Christianity. I mean, this is the common denominator behind so much of what's going on today. And this is why they want, of course, not only to create a one-world order, they want to create a one-world religion. This is why George Bush, after snookering the Christians of this country for 8 years, pretending to be a Christian, came out just as he's leaving office saying, well, there are lots of ways to God, and certainly the Bible isn't necessarily the Word of God. It's got a lot of good stories in it. And here's a man who pretended for 8 years to be a Christian. In fact, we did an interview just this last week with Russ Baker and his book called Family of Secrets. That's Family of Secrets. And basically, Russ Baker pointed out that they figured how they were going to scam the Christians. They did it. But behind all of this is an intense hatred of Christianity. Hold on there. So, you know, I share your concern about the covering up the Christian symbols. You must understand that Barack Obama says what we want to hear, but you have to watch what he...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our Founding Fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-.
Depended upon those of you who listen to our program primarily to keep our 60 outlets every week on the air. We're trying to reach people, try to get them to think. A lot of people will just hear our half-hour program one time a week. Sometimes we have probably close to 20 stations that will hear our programs every day. What we need are more and more stations, more and more opportunity to hear the truth, because you're not going to get it through regular channels. And most people, well, they don't want to be controversial. They don't want to be accused of believing in a conspiracy. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you, I believe there is a conspiracy against God. And if you don't believe it, you pull out your Strong's Concordance or go to your library and get a Strong's Concordance and look up the word conspiracy. And the Lord uses that word over and over again in His Word. And if it's good enough for the Lord, I think it's good enough for us. We have to understand that, just as Ruby had brought out during the call there at the end of the program, that we see that Barack Obama goes before into a religious organization. He's going to be speaking in a religious amphitheater or a religious hall, and they request that they cover up the Christian symbols there. And of course, it's because there is a conspiracy. There is an intense hatred of God. Now, they're not going to come out and tell you, but why do you think they took God and prayer out of our schools? Because it was the Constitution? No, of course not. It was because they want to destroy the Christian foundation of this country. That's why you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's why you need to hear my talk, The Forbidden Secret, and get the syllabus that goes with that. We're making a special offer now. You can get all three of the DVDs in the Secret Mystery of America's Beginning series. That's the Secret Mystery DVD. The Riddles and Stone DVD and the Eye of the Phoenix DVD. And for a suggested gift of $59.95, well, you can get all the three of them. That's a very, very good deal. And, of course, you kind of pay for postage, but it'll give you the information that you need, and certainly I play a very small part in it, a very small part, but the one thing I contributed, and I think it's important, was to realize that this was predominantly a Christian nation when it was founded, but the members of the secret societies and the occult organizations, all descendants of the mystery religions, were here starting at about 1640, and of course their goal was always to take control of our government and use America's military and financial power to bring about this one world government. And that's why we have our troops stationed in 130 or 131 nations today. And that's why we still have troops stationed in Germany, 60 years after the Second World War ended, and Japan 60 years after the Second World War ended, and in South Korea 50 years after the Korean War ended. That is, of course, why we are sending our jobs overseas. That's why we're sending our wealth overseas. That's why when we're having to borrow $3,000 a day to pay our bills, we're giving foreign aid to nations throughout the world. And, of course, you know what foreign aid is. That's where you take money away from poor people in a rich country to give it to a rich and corrupt people in a poor country. And that's exactly what we're doing. But only when you, of course, read the Earth Charter, which is one of the major documents that they put out, explains exactly what they're up to. And if you want a copy of that and you get anything else from Radio Liberty, ask for a copy of the Earth Charter. Read it through. Note point 10A and 10B, where they talk about equitable distribution of wealth between nations. That's why they've got to send your money overseas. That's why they're going to destroy the value of our currency, so they can impoverish our people. That's why we're going to green energy, so they can double or triple the cost of electricity, so you're not going to be able to afford electricity. That's why they want to lower your living standards. After all, why should you have so much when the people in Somalia have so little? Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, please go to our website and pray for Radio Liberty. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Grieg, formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, writing a blog and writing certainly books and appearing on our program and other programs and sharing his wisdom and his knowledge with people across America and or effort to wake people up to what's going on, to try to get them to think and to challenge everything that they've learned in college and in school and everything they're hearing in so many of our churches, what they're hearing on television, what they're hearing on the radio. We have to be able to think. We have to be able to challenge. We have to understand there is one underlying theme, and that is there is an organized effort to destroy America, to create a one-world government, a one-world currency, a one-world financial system, and a one-world religion. William, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, thank you once again for having me on as a guest.
Well, let's pick up. What are we going to talk about this evening?
As is usually the case, we have to confront some of the most deeply entrenched illusions and the illusions that are holding minds hostage. You have to free people's minds in order for individual liberty of action and individual liberty in the economic realm to take root. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about this evening was the brazenness with which some of the elements of the government that rules us right now and some of the people who advise the government in its various policies and programs, the brazenness with which these people are attacking rudimentary basic concepts of right and wrong, of the rule of law and the way that law is supposed to protect individual liberties. There's nothing more basic, in my opinion, than the proposition that a free individual has a God-ordained right to self-defense, whether you're talking about self-defense in the most elemental fashion, which is hand-to-hand, mano a mano, to use the common Spanish expression, or whether you're talking about the right to armed self-defense, which could include anything from a rock to a stick to an edged weapon to a firearm. And the proposition that the individual has this right is, of course, protected by the Second Amendment of the Constitution, but if that amendment didn't exist, as a matter of fact, if our Constitution didn't exist, in a state of nature, people still have that right. That's something that was given to us by our Creator. And it's a matter of ancient wisdom, ancient knowledge, that you can read about in texts going all the way back to ancient Greece or even earlier. You can actually read about this in the Old Testament, which is a much better source than anything you read from the ancient Greeks, that the difference between a citizen or a free man and a slave is that a free man or a free citizen of a republic or of a city-state has the right to bear arms in defense of himself and his family and his community. And a slave is somebody who has to delegate that right, or has alienated that right to somebody else. You go back to the book of 1 Samuel, where the Israelites, having repudiated the blessing of living without a terrestrial government, ended up under the rule of King Saul. One of the first tasks that was given to King Saul was to free a family of Israelites who were being oppressed by having their arms taken away from them. And that was really the first and most important duty that rested with him as the protector of the rights of the Israelites, was to vindicate the right of these Israelites to defend themselves against their oppressors.
In fact, you remember, Chris, during the time of slavery here in the United States, why no black man could, of course, have a weapon.
Yeah.
The same was true of apartheid, the apartheid system in South Africa. Even though they were trying to remedy the situation, they would not allow the blacks at that time to carry weapons. Now they all have them. Now go right ahead.
They all have the weapons over in South Africa. The biggest problem, of course, is that nobody in South Africa to speak of understands the concept of reciprocal protection of rights. There's this understanding that people can use weapons to obtain what they want, but there's not this understanding of the golden rule principle that we have to have reciprocal respect for rights, which means that you can't take your weapons and simply use them to steal from other people. And unfortunately, South Africa, once in recent memory, being a very civilized place, this, of course, is not a question of race or not a question of ethnicity, it was one of the most civilized places in that part of the world. The same thing was true of Rhodesia before it became Zimbabwe, but it has been rebarbarized through the imposition of a collectivist government that is largely the creation of the Western elites, the Anglo-American elites that we, I think, quite properly trash every time we have a conversation. But with respect to this principle of individual rights and the right to keep and bear arms as a way of protecting that which has been given to us by way of our individual liberty and our property, I mentioned the fact that King Saul was commanded to come to the rescue of this one little tribe of Israelites who was being oppressed by, I believe, the ancestors, the Philistines. A tribute was being exacted from this group of Israelites in the form of having every one of the males of this tribe thrust out his right eye, which just seems like a really gratuitously cruel way of establishing a proprietary mark on a conquered people, until you understand that the arms of the time that the common man could use required the ability to aim with depth perception. We're talking primarily about slings, but we're also talking about spears or lances. If you thrust out your dominant eye, then you don't have the depth perception. You can no longer use your arms to challenge those who are holding reign over you as tyrants. And so what was going on is that these men were being forcibly disarmed, permanently disarmed in a very horrible way. And this is something that, according to the book of 1 Samuel, God was not going to allow to prevail among the Israelites. And so after the Israelites rebelled against God, and God condescended to permit them to have a king, a monarchy, rather than having a decentralized patriarchal government administered by judges, there was still a requirement in the book of the law that was written by the prophet Samuel for the king of the Israelites to defend the rights of the Israelites. I mean, it was actually a constitutional monarchy. We read, I believe, in chapter 9 of 1 Samuel about how Samuel wrote up the book of the law of the Lord that was supposed to govern the government. They had a constitution, and that constitution required, among other things, that the government defend the natural and unalienable right of free people to retain the means of defending themselves, because the government's not supposed to be exercising that function. We don't want a government...
Hold that thought. Wait a minute. Right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We are simply talking about, of course, what it was in the days of Samuel and the days of Saul, when, of course, Saul's purpose was to allow the people to be armed, Israelites to be armed, because that was the symbol of a free people. People have to have weapons, not only to defend themselves from foreign enemies, but from despotism by the king. And that is, of course, why the liberals in this country, people like Dianne Feinstein, who had a gun permit when she was the mayor of San Francisco because she wanted to defend herself. And Rosie O'Donnell has armed up bodyguards because she wants to defend herself, but both women want to disarm the rest of us because, of course, we're just common people. We're not part of the elite. And Diane finds the most hypocritical person back in Washington, D.C., member of the Trilateral Commission, I might add, is demanding gun control. Why? Because she doesn't want the common people to be able to defend themselves, but she wants herself to be able to be defended. Go right ahead.
That's exactly right. And it shouldn't surprise us, therefore, that every time we find ourselves discussing the prospect of what is called gun control, that there's always this codicil in every so-called gun control proposal that would exempt not only the agents of state authority, which is to say the military and the police, but it would also exempt those who are granted a special type of license in order to protect people who are credentialed members of the opinion-molding elite. Those people will always benefit from our protection, whereas the rest of us, the mundanes, the common people, the hoi polloi, however you want to characterize us, we would simply be at the mercy of those who would retain this privilege, this now newly minted privilege of bearing arms or having armed protection. Now, one of the reasons I bring this up is because there's this remarkable story in the city of Milwaukee and its excerpts involving one of the most arrogant public officials I've ever come across, the police chief of Milwaukee. He was appointed to that position in January of last year. His name is Edward Flynn. He most recently, before being appointed to head of the Milwaukee Police Department, was a police chief in Springfield, Massachusetts. While he was there, he made himself notorious for, among other things, his quite open and brazen militarization of that police department. One of the things that he suggested was that the police ought to make themselves a conspicuous and ominous presence by wearing black all of the time. Now, black is not a color that we associate with freedom here in this country, at least when we're talking about a uniform scheme. It can be used for various suitable purposes in other items of couture, but when you're talking about garbing the enforcement agency of a local government in black, in black military attire, which is to say military blouses, fatigue pants, and the types of footwear and other accoutrements that we would associate with a military unit. Now, you're not talking about something that really looks like a police force. You're looking at something that acts and looks like an army of occupation. Well, that's Mr. Flynn's mindset, and he's now the police chief in Milwaukee. Milwaukee, for the last 5 or 6 years, has been notorious for a constant string of very egregious incidents of police brutality and abuse of power by police. They've come into quite a bad reputation in the state of Wisconsin, which is otherwise a fairly tranquil state. And so they went out and they went shopping for police chiefs. They found this man who, in addition to having a number of police chief positions on his resume, is also a graduate of the National Academy of the FBI in Quantico, Virginia. And also he's a graduate of the National Executive Institute, a former fellow at the Harvard School of Government, which seems like an unlikely part of the vita of a police chief. He sits on the Executive Committee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police and the Board of Directors for the Council of State Governments Justice Center. So you're dealing with somebody here who's really quite credentialed and used to hobnobbing in the most rarefied realms of the policymaking elite. Now, last August, there was a weird incident in which a fellow by the name of Brad Krause, who lives in a suburb of Milwaukee called West Allis, was in his backyard planting a tree. It happens, Mr. Krause is a landscaper by profession. He was planting a tree in his backyard when suddenly he was waylaid by a group of police who told him to put his hands in the air. They threw him face down on the dirt in his own backyard, and they put him under arrest because his neighbor had phoned in a complaint. Mr. Krause is in the habit of wearing a sidearm. Under Wisconsin law, this is not illegal. It is illegal in Wisconsin to carry a concealed firearm, but there's no law against open carry of a firearm. As a matter of fact, it's something that the Attorney General just this past week ratified by way of saying that because it's not illegal, there's no reason for the police to be treating the open carrying of a firearm as a crime of any sort. But nonetheless, Mr. Krause was arrested on the basis of this complaint by this timorous, busybody snitch of a neighbor who's just made out of exactly that combination of vile things that the Homeland Security State requires of its subjects. He was made uncomfortable by the fact that his law-abiding and inoffensive neighbor wore a sidearm. Now, of course, this person was not made uncomfortable by the fact that people in government employ are seen wearing sidearms. It's the fact that another private citizen was carrying a sidearm that made this person start to lose bladder control. So he calls the police. Mr. Krause ends up face first in his own backyard. He has his .40 caliber handgun seized from him. They didn't give him a receipt, the police, when they seized his firearm. And he finds himself up on charges of disorderly conduct. Now, he'd done nothing. He was in his own backyard on his own property. He was doing nothing to anybody. But because of this complaint, he ends up in this situation. Earlier this year, I believe it was February of this year, the judge convened a pretrial hearing and vacated the charge of disorderly conduct against Brad Krause, but he was not permitted to get his firearm back. Remember, the police didn't give him a receipt. They just straight up stole his gun from him. It's a very expensive gun. It was never used to commit a crime of any sort. It was his property. But because police are increasingly in the business now of stealing from law-abiding citizens, this was something that didn't surprise me at all. I've seen this sort of thing happen across the country. Now, on April 20th, as I mentioned, the Attorney General of Wisconsin, a fellow by the name of J.B. Van Hollen, issued a very brief memorandum in which he grudgingly admitted that a person has the right to openly carry a firearm, and I'm quoting now from that memorandum, without being subject to a charge of disorderly conduct. There's no, and this is the direct quote now. The department, meaning, of course, the department headed by the Attorney General, believes that mere open carry of a firearm, absent additional facts and circumstances, should not result in a disorderly conduct charge. And once again, you're not permitted in Wisconsin to exercise your right, and it is a right, to carry a concealed firearm, but if you carry one in the open, there's no reason to treat that as a criminal offense. Now, this brings us again to Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn, this fellow who's got that long and exalted pedigree that I mentioned a few minutes ago. Now, when Edward Flynn was asked to comment upon this opinion, this really legally binding opinion by the state's attorney general, this is the following response that he offered, according to the Chicago Tribune. Quote, "My message to my troops is, if you see anybody carrying a gun on the streets of Milwaukee, we'll put them on the ground, take the gun away, and then decide whether you have a right to carry it." Now, there are a number of things wrong with that statement. Let's begin with the first phrase, "my message to my troops." My troops? This is the police chief of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He is not a commanding general of a military body, but his attitude, as I mentioned before, with respect to his history in Springfield, Massachusetts, and elsewhere, is that of a military commander. He approaches this as if he were the military governor or the military dictator of a population that is under military occupation. So it doesn't surprise me at all to see that he referred to his police officers as my troops. Secondly, the fact that he's simply defying the legally binding opinion of the state attorney general here, who is the state attorney general being the chief prosecutor of that state government, is saying that there is not a crime that is being committed when somebody is carrying a firearm, that you have to have some kind of a supplemental reason that would amount to probable cause to be treating this person as a suspect. What Mr. Flynn is saying is that he will ignore that opinion as if it weren't binding on his law enforcement officers. The third fact that I find interesting here is the idea that he would summarily decide what is and what is not an individual right. Now, that's really lawlessness compounded by arrogance, multiplied by stupidity, and what it amounts to, of course, is the type of tyranny that our founding fathers specifically tried to protect us from by ensuring that the right to keep and bear arms would not be in any way delimited by laws or other kinds of policies. The other thing I find interesting is that in the context of this statement, by way of justifying what he said regarding throwing people face down and seizing their firearms, Mr. Flynn pointed out that Milwaukee has averaged about 100 homicides a year over the last 2 years, which is pretty high body count in terms of violent crime. The thing is, what he is saying, of course, is that by virtue of the fact that it is dangerous to live in Milwaukee, he will take that fact and use it as an excuse to disarm the innocent so as to enhance the danger that the innocent would experience vis-a-vis the armed criminal element. you're not going to be disarming the criminal element. The criminal element is a little bit too shrewd to be disarmed in the way that Mr. Flynn is talking about. These are the people who have something to hide. They will undertake to hide whatever it is that they're trying to conceal from the police. Those who are trying to deter criminals, those law-abiding citizens who have some experience in the use, maintenance of a firearm and can responsibly use them for self-defense, have no reason to hide these firearms. So this is a policy that will select for the benefit of the criminal element and select against the interests of the law-abiding, which is how civilian disarmament always works in practice and in principle.
Well, it's rather frightening that we would have police officers, police chiefs who would have this attitude and so little respect for the Second Amendment of the Constitution. But the problem is, of course, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely everyone, and especially when you're a police chief. Now, our police chiefs need to be schooled in the Constitution. They must understand they are the servants of the people, not the masters of the people. And, of course, then they will have the support of the people in maintaining law and order. Otherwise, it becomes us against them, and that would be the worst possible thing that could happen in a free nation.
It is a terrible thing when you take a look at the extent to which the attitudes just described here on the part of Chief Flynn of Milwaukee have become commonplace among many police administrators across this country. And, of course, that has the impact of turning the sentiments of the educated and public-spirited part of the citizenry against the police departments. The thing that's really unfortunate, of course, is that there's this effort to alienate police officials, including, of course, line officers, beat cops and patrol officers and people who are in the business of law enforcement, to alienate them from the public. This effort to cultivate an us-versus-them mentality has been going on for quite a while with respect to the training and orientation of police officers. Now, it is to the considerable credit that many, I'm willing to bet still, most police officers have resisted this effort to instill within them an adversarial sense of their relationship with the public. But the policies that are being handed down, not only at the federal level, not only with respect to the institutionalized apparatus of law enforcement, but also to the various sociological vectors that feed into modern law enforcement, the attitudes and policies that are being handed down of necessity pit police officers against the law-abiding elements of the public. And part of that's a function of the fact that we simply have too many laws. I mean, we don't need as many laws as are on the books. The only being in the universe that has the right, ultimately, to create laws gave us 10, and then he narrowed them down basically to 2 during the time of his mortal ministry described in the New Testament. We don't really need, in order to have a society that is a society ruled by law, in the interest of maintaining individual liberty and the security of property, this antic, demented, deranged profusion of laws that we're dealing with. As a matter of fact, Congress should be in the business of repealing laws so as to make more simple the task of understanding what it is that we're expected to do by way of maintaining a society that is genuinely lawful. But that's part of the problem. Another part of the problem is that the locus of authority over law enforcement has been shifted from the community, shifted beyond the states to the federal government. And beyond the federal government, really, it's been redirected toward this numinous and amorphous ruling elite that really knows no geographic loyalties or any cultural attachments or affinities, this power elite that we talk about quite frequently. And I think the fact that Chief Flynn is in part a product of the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government is a really good example of what I'm talking about. That's really the incubator for the type of internationalist attitudes and the type of presumptuous big government nanny state attitudes that lead people to believe that they're made out of better stuff than the rest of us. Because they're made out of better and more refined stuff, they simply have the right to dictate how the rest of us will live, because they're part of the Olympian overclass and the rest of us are simply the raw material of their grand designs and social engineering. One of the things that happened just in the last couple of days that bears directly on this subject is the fact that Congress is taking up once again the recertification and the reenactment of the COPS program from the 1993-1994 omnibus crime bill under Bill Clinton, it really is a perfect illustration of the fact that the Obama administration is a full-fledged, fully-orbed Clintonian restoration.
Hold that thought, will you? We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty with Will Gregg. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Sydney, and before we go on, oh no, that we'll go right ahead now until the half-hour break, but Sydney William is just simply talking how the Obama administration is the Clinton administration all over again, except this time Hillary has the key position in government,
yeah.
Whereas before she was simply the first lady of our nation. Go right ahead.
Yeah, before she didn't really have any policy-making... official policy-making portfolio, and now she's in the line of presidential succession, which is a much more prominent, much more powerful post than being the spouse of the president. But one of the things I was mentioning is that during the Clinton administration's first term, way back in 1993-1994, one of the things that really set the teeth on edge of a lot of the public here, that is to say the constitutionally-minded public, was his COPS initiative, where you had the federal government directly funding the training and provisioning of what were described as something like 100,000 police officers, which really isn't that much in raw numbers. But more importantly, you're dealing with the principle that they would be the leaven that would leaven the whole lump. If you have, say, a handful of federally funded officers in key departments across the country, then under the principle that that which the government subsidizes it controls, you're extending federal control over these civilian police departments. And that has to do, once again, with the idea that the locus of control is shifting from the communities where police officers are supposed to be exercising their authority on behalf of the law-abiding citizenry back to Washington, D.C., and they're going to be reflecting the political priorities of the people who cut the paychecks or the people who issue the subsidy checks. So you have the COPS program being revived by Congress. You have the Byrne Grant program, which is being revived as part of the so-called stimulus program. The Byrne Grant, B-Y-R-N-E, grant program, has been used over the last 10 years or so. I think it's been 10 years since it was introduced as a way of bringing federal funds into a state or even into a municipal police department to create counter-narcotics task forces that are involved in, among other things, the running of snitches, the running of informants, paid informants, in order to gather information, intelligence on supposed narcotics deals, and also to get involved in programs of asset forfeiture. And asset forfeiture, once again, in many instances, amounts to plain theft, where police will seize money or property and hold it in rem. That means against the thing. They will through the local prosecutor's office, file a civil action, a lawsuit against the thing, against the item of property or against the quantity of money, and they will hold the property or the money guilty of some kind of involvement in narcotics trafficking. That would get around the necessity of proving that the person who actually is entitled to that property, the person who owned that property, had committed a crime and could have the property seized pursuant to law. This is a way of getting around due process. It's a very lucrative racket. It is a racket. It is a criminal enterprise in almost every circumstance where it's employed. It's one of the most lucrative rackets in America right now, and it's one of the ways where law enforcement bodies have been corrupted by the influence of the federal government. And so when you're looking upon the public here as a potential source of illicit revenue, and you're being encouraged to do this by the federal government, it's going to cultivate an adversarial perspective on the public on the part of people in law enforcement, which is, of course, a terrible thing. I'm old enough, I'm 46 years old, I'm old enough to remember when most people implicitly trusted your local beat cop or your local sheriff, people who looked at somebody who wore the uniform of the local police, for the most part, considered them to be eminently trustworthy. The advice that was given to every child when I was growing up was, if you ever get lost, find a policeman. Find a policeman, he will take care of you, and he'll get you home safely. And on more than one occasion, I made use of that advice. When I was very young, when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, I spent a lot of time in the company of police officers as a teenager, and this is something that you can no longer do, I found out. I would go frequently on ride-alongs with deputy sheriffs into the police officers late at night after I was finished with my summer jobs. I would spend a lot of time in the company of police officers and study how they did what they did. As a journalist with The New American, on more than a few occasions, I spent a lot of time in the company of police detectives, particularly people who were working in the realm of international organized crime. I broke a lot of stories having to do with criminal syndicates that were allowed to take root in this country through the corrupt influence of the federal government. So I'm not intrinsically or constitutionally inhospitable to law enforcement. I'm just among those who lament the fact that it is being radically transformed from within in ways that are incompatible with the constitutional protection of individual rights.
Hold that thought, William. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest, of course, is William Grigg, and we're going to be talking about the progressive erosion of the power of the local police as we move from a local police force to a fascist sort of a society where the police are controlled out of Washington, D.C., and answerable to those people in the central government. William, go right ahead, pick the story up.
One of the things that has happened just in the last, say, 25 years that has really had an adverse impact on law enforcement has been the commingling of law enforcement and military functions. That's something I talk about, of course, in my most recent book, Liberty and Eclipse, and it's something that a number of people have been studying very carefully now for the last 15 years in particular, since about 1993, 1994. Really, the break point for a lot of this stuff was the first Clinton term, 1993-94, and it wasn't as if these things originated with the Clinton administration. You can go back and see where even in the Reagan administration there was an effort to get around posse comitatus restrictions on the use of the military in law enforcement under the rubric of the war on drugs, which is one of the most litigious frauds ever perpetrated on the American public, the so-called war on drugs. You got the CIA actively promoting the propagation of narcotics trafficking throughout the Western Hemisphere and on the streets of American cities, on the one hand, and on the other, you've got the three-letter agencies and law enforcement working hand-in-glove with local law enforcement to fight a plague that the CIA has been propagating. And in the course of this, you have these huge exceptions carved out of the Posse Comitatus restrictions that allow the military to get involved in the whole mess. And by the time you end up really getting a handle on what's going on, suddenly the countryside all across the United States is riven with violence that didn't exist before, where you've got full-force SWAT team raids being undertaken to serve common warrants or to carry out common arrest procedures against people who are suspected of being in possession of narcotics, not people who are involved in dealing narcotics. You end up with these late-night raids or early morning raids that are something out of Kafka-esque fiction.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is William Grigg, and we're talking certainly about the so-called war on drugs, which is phony as a $3 bill, after all. When the wicked Taliban, these brutal criminals, you know, were controlled Afghanistan, they did away with the heroin crops. Now that the heroic Americans are there, you know, defending freedom, why the poppy fields are blooming, and Afghanistan is now the largest exporter of heroin in the world. In fact, they're growing more than they ever have before. And how can that be? Well, maybe, ladies and gentlemen, reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. Maybe there are people within our government who are deeply involved in the narcotic trade, and they certainly don't want to cut off the supply. Maybe that's one reason we invaded Afghanistan, so we could ensure the supply for the Central Intelligence Agency to use for their black operations. But let's get back to our special guest, who's William Grigg. And William, I want you to get your blog site out so people will know how they can get in touch with you.
I sure appreciate that. The easiest way to get there is to go to willgrigg.com. That's willgrigg.com. And once you go to willgrigg.com, look at the right-hand side of the screen, and there's a list of external links. And at the top of that list of external links, there's a hot link, a hyperlink to Pro Libertate, which is my blog. I update it between, say, 3 and 5 times a week. And the Pro Libertate blog doesn't function the way that a lot of other blogs do. This is not a 3-paragraph and link type of a situation where you get a very brief excerpt or a very brief write-up of another story that is linked to off-site from the blog. It's not a running commentary. It's not a diary. What I do is I write an essay between 1,200 and 2,000 words usually that I publish usually, once again, every other day or so as my schedule permits. Sometimes I get a little bit over-ambitious. I've recently published essays that are over 4,000 words in length. I don't say that by way of trying to scare away readers, but you should be forewarned that if you go to Pro Libertate, the essays are going to be longer. They're going to be a little more challenging because I'm trying to use Pro Libertate to do journalism the first instance where I can, and where I can't do that, to try to advance a story beyond what merely is involved in commenting upon the works of others. So you're reading opinion pieces. I don't disguise my point of view. I'm not trying to say that what I write is purely objective, because I certainly have my own biases. But I try to buttress them with some type of new or fresh investment of effort to try to advance the story beyond that which I simply find as I read a number of sources and that are widely available on the Internet. So Pro Libertate is investigative polemics. It's editorial commentary, hopefully with an element of investigative journalism to it. I'm also involved in providing commentary on Lou Rockwell's blog site. He republishes a lot of the essays from Pro Libertate. Lou Rockwell, of course, is the president of the Mises Institute. And his website, lourockwell.com, is one of the better read and more widely read blog sites on the Internet for people of paleoconservative or libertarian perspectives. And at the right-hand border of his website, you find the Lou Rockwell blog, and I've been doing a lot of writing on the Lou Rockwell blog site this past week. That's lourockwell.com. So if you go to willgrigg.com, that's sort of the entree to all this stuff. If you go to the Pro Libertate website and you read through to the end of an essay, at the bottom, there's a thumbnail photograph of the cover of my most recent book, Liberty in Eclipse. And there's also a hyperlink that will take you to Amazon.com to order the book if you're so interested, that you appreciate it. Buying that book is one of the main ways to support my work here through a Pro Libertate. It's also available through Radio Liberty. Excuse me. The book Liberty in Eclipse is about 300 pages long, but it's not heavy reading. And it covers a lot of the material that is relevant to the discussion this evening with respect to the militarization of law enforcement and the creation and now the tragic efflorescence of this homeland security state that we're living with right now. I guess, gratified that a lot of people are finally starting to wake up to the fact that the powers, the presidency, and the powers of the central government in general were dangerously enhanced during the reign of George Bush the Younger, and that this is something that has been going on for a number of decades. I think that the fact that the presidency is in the hands of somebody who is visibly and obviously sort of a cultural revolutionary figure has left a lot of people unsettled over the fact that this individual now has the powers of an elected short-term dictator at his disposal. There are those of us who were alarmed at this development, irrespective of the announced ideological or partisan affiliations of the president, that this is just as dangerous under George W. Bush as it is under Barack Obama, it was just as dangerous under Bill Clinton as it was under George Bush the Elder. And so that much is certainly refreshing, but it's very limited, the fact that people are waking up to this and being alarmed over it. They're still fixating too much on the personality of the person in the White House rather than fixating on the principles involved here. And that's one of the oldest and most lethal mistakes that people make. You can go all the way back and read, I believe, in the writings of Montesquieu, who was the French political scientist and jurist who was very influential on the minds of the founding fathers, particularly Madison, talking about the need for separation of powers. But one of the principles he talked about is he examined the history of Rome and its decline from being a republic into being an empire, was that people fixated too frequently. As far as the Romans were concerned, they fixated too frequently on the faults and the virtues, the perceived virtues of a ruler, rather than on the powers that were given to the rulers. And that by virtue of doing so, they daily riveted their chains. That their chains were riveted by their misunderstanding of what to focus on. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about somebody who is as stainless as the fair and perfect knight described by Geoffrey Chaucer, or if you're dealing with somebody who is a complete wretch. The fact is that you can't trust fallen man with political power. And so the question is, what kinds of things are these people authorized to do? What are they permitted to do by law? What are they forbidden to do by law? And furthermore, what is the purpose of law itself? Is the purpose of law to restrict what the government can do, to compel it to do those things that are necessary to protect our liberty, to protect our property, and to do no more than that? If you understand law to have that purpose, then you're fully in step with the Americanist concept of how government should operate. If, on the other hand, you believe that the purpose of law is to compel the people to do those things that the government ordains that it do, that they do, on the assumption that the government basically is in control of the economy, and that the government has the privilege, the people who run the government have the privilege of using us as raw material for their social experiments, then you're of a collectivist point of view. When, unfortunately, the latter point of view is prevailing right now to a terrifying extent in our country. I think the former is making a comeback. I certainly hope that we'll be able to rally people to that perspective while we still have time to recover what remains of our liberties and restore those that have been taken from us.
I certainly concur. Well, I think it's important that people understand that there really are people out there who want a dictatorship in America. They've been planning it for a long time. And all one has to do, you know, is simply go into the bank and notice the video cameras and go into the 7-Eleven and you see the video cameras. But they're putting them on the highways. They're putting them on the street corners. They're putting them in the halls in our schools, and they're putting them in the classrooms, and they're putting them every place. And this is, of course, to keep track, not of the criminals, but of the law-abiding citizens. Why do you think they're using the satellites that were built at great expense to spy on the wicked communists? Why are they using them to watch us today? I mean, we could go down the line, that's certainly what they're doing with the cell phones, so they can add the software now, so they can listen to your conversations, even when your cell phone's turned off. They can actually track where you are, even when your cell phone is turned off, because of the software in your cell phone. Understand all of these things that are simply preludes to a dictatorship in America. It is organized, it is orchestrated, and it is happening as part of a long-range plan. But go right ahead.
Indeed, we're talking about the weirdest phase of our history as a nation, and perhaps the most peculiar phase of recorded history, in that it seems as if the government that rules us right now, and by that, of course, I'm referring to the apparatus of coercion and regimentation, which is in the hands of this overclass that we constantly refer to, the power elite, to use the C. Wright Mills expression. I think that's the best way of describing them. However you describe that numinous they who are running things, they operate through the government that rules us right now in ways that are really quite remarkable. I mean, it's no longer the case that we have a government that represents or that even rules the American people, so much as it's become an appendage of this kleptocratic elite that runs the banking system. It's almost as if the government itself has become a moderate and minor appendage to this banking cartel. And a kleptocratic government is a government of thieves. You know, we talk about kleptomania, that is a penchant tendency, an insurmountable impulse to steal. And a kleptocrat is somebody who rules through thievery, through robbery. We've got a situation right now where almost the entire gross domestic product of the United States last year, within a basically a rounding error of the entire gross domestic product, has been siphoned away to bail out these immensely corrupt and profligate banks that profited handsomely off of the fraud that was propagated by the Federal Reserve during the late housing bubble, and before that during the dot-com bubble, and before that during bubbles of various kinds. And you had a gross domestic product in 2008. It was something of the order of about $14 trillion. The Federal Reserve's money that has been spent, lent, or promised, guaranteed on behalf of the banks now, amounts to something a little more than $13 trillion. So you've got basically a little less than $1 trillion difference between that which the Federal Reserve has been providing in terms of promises and the monetization of these bad debts on the one hand, everything that we earned last year. So basically they're stealing the entire country's wealth in order to lavish it on the most corrupt element of the banking cartel. And so we take a look at what's going on right now by way of the policies that are being announced in order supposedly to get us out of the economic collapse that is now descended upon us. There is a remarkable piece just this last week in the New York Times by, I believe his name is pronounced Manco, N. Gregory Manco, who's associated with the Federal Reserve System, who was an advisor to George W. Bush. In other words, one of the architects of our current collapse. The title of this was, "It May Be Time for the Fed to Go Negative." Of course, Mr. Manco, being a Federal Reserve apparatchik, is a missionary, an apostle of the gospel of John Maynard Keynes, the socialist who was the architect of the New Deal and whose fundamental insight, such as it is, into economics holds that really the only way that you prosper is having the government spend as much as is necessary in order to increase aggregate demand in the event of an economic contraction. So what this article from the New York Times is saying is that something has to be done in order to get people to borrow and spend more, because right now most people are so worried about the economy. Those who still have jobs, those who still have money in the bank, are starting to husband their resources, or what is described as hoarding. They're husbanding their resources more responsibly. They're making do with less. So what he says is that we have to figure out a way to make holding money less attractive. Well, how do you do that? Well, what he says, we ought to be charging negative interest rates. This is something that was tried in Japan, as you recall, Dr. Stan, way back during the beginnings of their depression in the early 1990s. They actually were charging negative interest rates. So, for instance, you could borrow and spend $100 and repay $97 the next year. Now, that type of monetary intervention has not yet been tried by the Federal Reserve, but they tried it in Japan, and that's one of the reasons why their economic slump has gone on for about 20 years now. But by way of elaborating on this idea, Mr. Manco says, imagine that the Fed were to announce that a year from today, it would pick a digit from 0 to 9 out of a hat. All currency with a serial number ending in that digit would no longer be legal tender. Suddenly, the expected return to holding currency would become negative 10%. That move would free the Fed to cut interest rates below zero. People would be delighted to lend money at negative 3%, since losing 3% is better than losing 10. Of course, some people might decide that at those rates, they would rather spend the money, for example, by buying a new car. But because expanding aggregate demand is precisely the goal of the interest rate cut, such an incentive isn't a flaw, it's a benefit. The idea of making money earn a negative return is not entirely new. In the late 19th century, the German economist Silvio Gesell argued for a tax on holding money. He was concerned that during times of financial stress, people hoard money rather than lend it. John Maynard Keynes approved and excited the idea of a carrying tax on money. With banks now holding substantial excess reserves, Gesell's concern about cash hoarding suddenly seems very modern. If all this seems too outlandish, there is a more prosaic way of obtaining negative interest rates, through inflation. Suppose that, looking ahead, the Fed commits itself to producing significant inflation. In this case, while nominal interest rates would remain at zero, real interest rates measured in purchasing power, could become negative. If people were confident that they could repay their zero-interest loans and devalued dollars, they would have significant incentive to borrow and spend. Well, once again, this is the same old nonsense that he's ending up promoting here by way of inflation being the panacea to a problem that inflation created. But what I find remarkable here is, first of all, the fact that they're resurrecting this ancient and terrible idea of a holding tax on money, you know, taxing people in such a way that they cannot afford to save money, which is the only way that we're going to get out of the depression that we're getting into, is that people have to save, and they have to produce, and they have to invest out of savings rather than investing out of inflation. And the second thing that I find remarkable here is this idea that you would have arbitrary repudiation of a certain quantity of fiat money as a legal tender for the purpose of goading people into spending more rather than saving. And this all illustrates, once again, the consumption fraud that is fiat currency. You couldn't say, for instance, if we were dealing with currency that were real constitutional money, such as gold or silver, that one-tenth of all the gold will suddenly be worth nothing, or one-tenth of all the silver is suddenly worth nothing because it's all intrinsically valuable. You could do that, of course, with fiat currency because it has no value. The only value that it has is based on the idea that the government forces us to accept it as legal tender for transactions involving debt. And so suddenly the creator of this debt-based fiat currency decides that every tenth banknote with a serial number ending in an arbitrarily determined digit is no longer going to be taken as legal currency. They can do this because that's, you know, it bears the likeness and inscription of Caesar. And so you're not dealing with real money, you're dealing with Caesar's counterfeit of the same. It's the same old story, and it's going to end badly.
Well, you know, what we really need is savings in production, not spending in consumption. But
exactly.
They don't want to address that issue. They want, of course, to ultimately create inflation and destroy the value of our currency, because there's no better way to destroy a great nation than, of course, to create inflation. That's what they're doing, they're botching our currency. They know what they're doing. And we've got to sound the alarm before it's too late, and everyone in this country has been impoverished, except, of course, for the elite. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Now, William, you go right ahead.
One of the things that I certainly hope people will remember here is that there are a handful of rules, a handful of laws that our Creator established long before we got involved in any of these political systems, any of these political debates that occupy so much of our time. Those laws are binding. They are as insurmountable as the law of gravity. The principles of human action that we call economics have to operate in harmony with God's laws. You simply cannot create value without exertion. I mean, that's like the law of the harvest. You get what you plant, you get what you cultivate, what you husband, what you sow, what you nurture. You simply cannot create arbitrary value by decree. The parables of Jesus are full of examples where the principles that we're talking about here with respect to sound economic policy are endorsed and elaborated upon by way of teaching eternal truths. And that's true with respect to the way that we treat each other in this system of government that we call a constitutional republic, which is supposed to be based upon the two great commandments. The two great commandments being love the Lord your God with all your heart, the second being love your neighbor as yourself. We recognize that our rights come from our Creator. We reverence our Creator. We acknowledge that He is sovereign. That, of course, is the first great commandment. And the second great commandment is the praxis of the second great commandment, is this reciprocal respect for and protection of individual rights under a system of law, in which we recognize that we protect our own rights by recognizing and protecting the rights of our neighbors. And one of the things that we do by way of carrying out this principle and obeying this law is to engage in mutually beneficial commerce. And, of course, there's a role for voluntary charity as well. We've got a system now, however, that is based upon plunder. It's based upon covetousness. It's based upon the idea that the government is exempt from God's law, that it can properly steal, that it somehow has some superluminary power that justifies the stealing from one party to enrich another party and to take a cut that enriches the redistributionist elite at the top. And we're reaching, quite frankly, the end of that racket at a point At some point, that racket will come grinding to a halt. It simply has to. And that, of course, is part of the function of these eternal laws that we're talking about here. We're at that point now. So we have to reacquaint ourselves with what works. What works, of course, is God's law, as intuited through nature, as it says in the first chapter of the book of Romans, and, of course, as it's outlined in the New Testament and the Bible. And so we're at a point where we've got to go back and like Josiah,
William,
grab the law of the Lord.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, I guess this has been William Grigg. And William, just make your parting statement, then I'll let you go.
All right. As I say, like King Josiah in the Old Testament, we have to go and retrieve the book of the law of the Lord, dust it off, and start living it. That's the only way we're going to get out of this mess.
Amen to that. And, Chrissy, you reap what you sow. And if you don't sow anything, or you honestly think that you can be prosperous, well, they think that they can create prosperity by printing money. But in the end, of course, we end up like Zimbabwe today.
Exactly.
God bless, William. Thanks
God
very
bless
much.
You. Take care.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was William Grigg. Hope you enjoyed our recent conversation with William Grigg. We would point out that in Zimbabwe, where we installed the government and we kept them in power under the name of humanitarian aid, actually it was sort of an experiment to see how things would work if you destroyed the currency. Now they're simply going to the banks and taking people's money out. In other words, you have an account in the bank. The government goes there and takes the money out. They steal your money. But that's perfectly all right because they're the government. And after all, they've been installed by the American State Department and Henry Kissinger, and they're being kept in power by the American State Department and Henry Kissinger through constant infusion of humanitarian aid. But we can't tell the American people that, or we can't really let the American people understand that Henry Kissinger is directing the current administration. And if you doubt that, we have the article from the Council on Foreign Relations. We'd be glad to send you a copy, where General James Jones, Director of National Security, gave a speech in Munich where he simply said, "Oh, I take my orders every day from Henry Kissinger. We have a chain of command in the National Security Council, and I take my orders every day from Henry Kissinger through General Brenchko-Croft and Sandy Berger." Understand, ladies and gentlemen, the same people are in charge. We're in charge and prolonged the Vietnam War, totally unnecessary, and killed millions of civilians, and of course killed 600,000 Cambodians with bombing there for no other purpose than just to kill civilians. But we weren't even at war with them. That was, of course, what turned the people against America and got them to back the Khmer Rouge. Most people don't understand. Our government backed the Khmer Rouge in 1980 under Reagan after they'd been responsible for the murder of almost 2 million Cambodians. But you're never going to hear about that. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, to understand what's going on. We're making a special offer where you can get the 3 DVDs in the Secret Mystery series, Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, Riddles in Stone, and Eye of the Phoenix, all 3 of them for a suggested gift of $59.95 plus shipping. We need to get my talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that. Our talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. The concentration camp, 4 tape set or DVD, or you can get the concentration camp special. And hear the congressman talking about the plan in case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution and put people in concentration camps. This is not imaginary. This is not crazy talk. We have people who have a different worldview because they hate the God of the Bible. And when you understand that, why, of course, everything going on makes great sense today. So certainly get the information. Go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet, shortwave. You can listen to them on shortwave, but on our website, you can hear them on the satellite feed 9 hours a day, the live feed. You can hear the archive programs. You can hear them on blog or MP3. Certainly, we want you to watch the DVDs we have posted and then the other DVD links, all of which we've checked and we think are important. Read our newsletters. Encourage other people to go there and get the information. Encourage them to listen to Radio Liberty. We need an army of people in America who understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged and the fact that there really are secret societies out there and covert organizations that are tied into the secret societies. And all you need to do is look at the logo of the Trilateral Commission. If you look very carefully, you can almost imagine you see 3 sixes. But you don't have to imagine. the center of the logo of the Trilateral Commission, the most powerful organization in America, where there's an upside-down broken cross. So then if you go to my website, RadioLiberty.com, listen to our November, December 2008, and of course January and February 2009 newsletters. Read them. Understand the Council on Foreign Relations and Bilderbergers are real. And please pray for Radio Liberty.
From the mountains to the prairie, to